Pendant qu'il s'installe, quelques mots. Donc Hiro est docteur de l'Université de Lille, docteur en histoire des sciences en 1999. Il est chercheur associé au centre... Il est chercheur associé au Centre d'histoire des sciences de l'Université de Liège. Il a été lauréat du prix des jeunes historiens de l'Académie internationale d'histoire des sciences à Paris. Il a été collaborateur du Wellcome Trust, le Center for the History of Medicine à Londres. Il est l'auteur de plusieurs articles sur la théorie de la semence chez Martin Fissin, chez Gassendi, chez Jean Fernel. Il a également rédigé récemment un très intéressant compte-rendu, très détaillé compte-rendu de la publication des œuvres complètes de Boyle. Et son ouvrage, Le concept de semence dans les théories de la matière à la Renaissance, vient juste de paraître la semaine dernière chez Brepols. Voilà. Quant à Hideyuki Yoshimoto, il est professeur d'histoire des sciences à la Tokyo University of Foreign Studies. Il a été visiting fellow à Birkbeck College à Londres en 1994. Il a consacré de nombreux articles à Robert Boyle et notamment The Natural Historical Background to Robert Boyle's Thought, Concept of Fermentation in Psyche, Boyle and Newton, Boyle and Spinoza, The Holy Stage of Robert Boyle's Chemistry. Nous avons donc le plaisir d'écouter le texte rédigé par Hiro à partir de leurs travaux communs.
Merci beaucoup.
Je n'ai pas donné le titre, donc c'est en anglais Anatomizing the Sceptical Chemist, Robert Boyle's Early Thoughts.
Merci. Naturellement, parler en français est plus facile pour moi. Vous entendez?
Oui.
Mais comme mon collègue n'est pas aise en français, alors nous avons choisi de présenter en anglais. Vous avez donc normalement 6 pages de handout. Peut-être recto verso? Ouais. Ouais, ça va. Je commence. In order to understand an author's thought in its philosophical and historical context, it is very important to trace the sources on which this author founded his ideas. It is through this procedure of canon forging that one can really measure his depth to forerunners as well as his originality. Every philosophical reconstruction risks being challenged by the discovery of a simple philosophical fact. The French alchemist Pierre Gassendi is widely viewed as a rational mechanist. However, I have shown in my book that his matter theory was heavily influenced by Renaissance chemical philosophy, namely by that of Garnish Paracelsian Petrus Severinus and his followers, whose tradition culminated in the Flemish chemist Jan Baptista van Helmont, often considered as an irrational mystic. This discovery shows the anachronism and invalidity of such a simplistic polarization between mechanical rational and chemical irrational. It also requires a total revaluation of Gassendi's thought, which will certainly change his received image. Let us now talk about the subject of our conference, Robert Boyle. Even a superficial reading of his writings, newly edited by Michael Hunter and Edward Davis, impresses us by his erudition, which presents itself from his early scientific writings. His knowledge is based not only on the classical authors, but also on those of the Renaissance and of his time. It is true that Boyle was scrupulous about gathering information from his own experiments, and through the network of his friends and colleagues. Fascinated by strange phenomena, he eagerly collected testimonies about them, following a Baconian program for experimental natural history. But this aspect has been so much emphasized that one sometimes forgets that he was also a child of book learning culture. Indeed, he seems to have widely read diverse types of literature, such as pharmacopoeias, great travelers' memoirs, natural histories, chemical recipes, etc. But a simple question comes to our mind. How could the young boy gather such an amount of knowledge in a very short time after 1649? Is there any possibility that he used some sort of guidebooks or commonplace books, compendia of doxographical nature? It is in this direction that my colleague and I are currently carrying our research in collaboration. In this paper, as the first report of this collaboration, we shall tackle the problem of sources of the young boy's ideas on the growth of metals, his favorite subject. In 1674, Boyle published a book, Hidden Qualities of the Air, included in the eighth volume of the new edition of his works. In this treatise, he describes, as a proof for the existence of the air's hidden qualities, the growth of metals which are extracted from the mines and exposed to the air. However, as he finds it inappropriate to develop a long discussion on the phenomenon at this point, he appends a few pages of observation, apparently based on his reading note. This piece is entitled Observations about the Growth of Metals in their Ore Exposed to the Air. He says that this piece is closely related to his essay on the regeneration of salts, which is included in certain physiological essays. Despite some revisions he made for its publication, its origin is thus situated in the early phase of his scientific career around 1660. Boyle states that the object of this piece is not to decide whether metals grow in the bowel of the earth like subterranean plants, the question traditionally discussed by alchemists, but to show that metals extracted and exposed to the air increase their weight or volume, and that a substance which was not a metal turns into a metal. However, since he estimates the experiments required to achieve this purpose are too difficult, he satisfies himself by observing the testimonies found in the writing of mineralogists, travelers, and the other authors of good credit. First, Boyle gives some reports on the growth of tin ore, whose mine was once emptied by miners and then naturally filled again in the course of time. His source of information remains unknown. Next, he takes up the case of lead. It seems to him that the growth of lead ore is more visible than that of other metals. In this account, he gives two quotations in Latin. Here he clarifies his source. For the first one, he even gives the page number of the copy in his possession. This treatise is the Decas Quaestionum Physico-Chemicorum de Metallis, published in Tübingen, 1643, written by Johann Gerhard, the professor of classical medicine of the University of Tübingen. He was also several times the rector of this Protestant university. Besides that, we know very little about this character. By a comparison of their text, Table 1, we can say that Boyle's quotation is faithful and exact. Without any interval, Boyle continues by quoting the second testimony for the growth of lead given by the most important authority of the 16th century on the mining world, Georg Agricola, from his treatise De Orchu et Causis Subterraneum. However, we soon realize that exactly the same extract is also found in Gerhard's text. Then we compare the wording of the three men, Table 2. It is possible to suspect that Bolo follows the quotation made by Gerhard rather than the original phrase of Agricola. Then, Boyle moves on to the report of a gentleman, a chemist and owner of lead mines, who has never seen the growth of lead ore. So, Boyle expresses his skepticism in regard to this phenomenon and tries to give a mechanical explanation. According to him, the water surrounding the mine, which imbibes the neighboring earth, is expanded by being turned into ice and gives cracks to the ore, hence its visible expansion. Although he says that this argument does not aim to deny the growth of the ore itself, but to contribute to further considerations, he estimates his proof more suitable than that given by some writers with the example of tin roofs for magnificent buildings. According to this kind of argument, the tin roofs should be replaced by glass ones because the buildings cannot support their increasing weight in the course of time. Once again, Boyle mentions Gerhard always with a page number, stating that this example used by some mineralogists, among others, the learned Gerhardus, as a proof for the growth of metals. But he believes that their argument is based on a misunderstanding, for he was thought that the increase in weight of tin roofs is not due to the real growth of metal itself. For him, saline corpuscles evaporate from the timber of these buildings and, by attaching to the roofs, produce a kind of alloy like cellulose and increase the weight of the roofs. So he wonders whether the famous testimony of Galen, to which these authors often refer, is a reliable argument to prove the real growth of the metal. We note that the new edition of his works does not identify these writers to whom Boyle makes allusion in this passage, as well as the locus of Galen's report. If we actually turn to the text of Gerhard, we find his discussion on lead ore too. After the testimony of Pliny the Elder on the growth of lead, he refers to Galen's account of the volume increase of lead joints for statues. This is taken from the treatise on the faculties of simple drugs, books 9, chapter 23. In the eyes of Gerhard, what Galen said is so true that several writers confirm it for the lead roofs of temples. He asked to this Thomas of Canterbury and Vincent of Beauvais, who talk about a more rapid growth of lead outside the mines than inside them, as well as Girolamo Cardano, who admits the weight increase of lead by calcination. Then, facing an objection made by Gabriel Falloppio against Galen, he quotes Andreas Cesarpino. According to Gerhard, this man agrees with alchemists like Petrus Bonus, the author of the famous Margarita Preciosa Novella, and wonderfully interprets the harmony of Aristotle and Galen in favor of the growth of lead. From this account, we can reasonably suppose that Boyle had in mind all these quotations made by Gerhard for his several writers. After the case of lead comes back from Ireland, as far as the minds of his country are concerned, Boyle did not find anything particular which might confirm the growth of iron ore. However, he did find some foreign testimonies, namely on the famous mine of the island of Elba. He states that not only the ancients like Strabo and Pliny, but also some modern authors of very good credit, such as Falloppio and Cesarpino, attest to the phenomenon. He quotes Cesarpino first. Here again, let us compare his quotation with the text of Gerhard, table 3. It is true that we cannot draw any definitive conclusion from this comparison alone, but for the time being, let us just note that their texts are almost identical. After Cesarpino, he quotes Agricola, without mentioning the fact that Gerhard also quotes the same piece only a few lines after that quotation from Cesarpino, table 4. Exactly the same omission of a phrase from Agricola's original sentence, I underline, sentence shows an evident parallel between Boyle and Gerhard. Then Boyle has a testimony taken from the learned Johann Gerhardus by giving his name clearly. It is an extract from a German treatise which Gerhard calls Concionis Metallicae. He does not give any more information about its author. Boyle proposes, in his turn, to identify this work to the High Dutch sermons of the Lutheran preacher Johann Maxius of St. Joachimstal, although he confesses that he is unable to read Maxius' language, German. We have so far been unable to identify the original passage in Maxius' treatise Zarepta oder Bergpostil. However, it is evident that Boyle relies only on the treatise of Gerhard in this passage, table 5. Then, as for the growth of gold, Boyle seems to have invested himself much in vain to find satisfying testimonies in the writing of great travelers. What he gives as likely is the report of the English writer Edward Brown, who visited several mines in Hungary and published his memoirs in 1673. As the editors of Boyle's new books have noted, this fact shows that although this piece on the growth of metals stems from the leading note of his youth, Boyle reworked on it nearly until its publication. But that is not all. At the end of the section on gold, Boyle inserts another extract in Latin by stating that if a late German professor of physics do not misinform him, Germany affords an eminent testimony on the growth or regeneration of gold. He does not clarify that he is quoting again from Gerhard, but simply calls the author of his source a late professor. This may give his readers an impression that he is relying on yet another source. Here again, let us compare his quotation with the text of Gerhard, table 6. This comparison shows that Boyle seems to have merely copied the text of Gerhard. But there is a supplementary piece of information. The fact that he puts a word late to the professor led us to think that he was informed of Gerhard's relatively recent death, which occurred in 1657, well after the publication of his treatise Decca's Question in 1643. After having given, as a postscript, two more narratives from Edward Brown on the mines in Hungary, Boyle claims that he had so far collected still more testimonies on the growth of metals than those he presented here. But since his scope is simply to show their growth by the exposure to the air, he ends this annexing piece to the hidden qualities of the air as such. Although it was reworked for the publication of 1674, its contents have a strong affinity with those of the early writings of his scientific career published around 1660, such as certain physiological essays and Skeptical Chemist. The same can be said in relation with his mineralogical manuscripts dated of the 1660s, which are published for the first time in the 13th volume of the new edition of his work. We shall now place the shadow of Gerhard in Boyle's production of this period. What is very striking is the fact which led us to think that, when he quotes in Latin, the writings of continental mineralogists like Agricola, Fallopio, and Cesarpino, he probably does not give a direct look to their texts, but rely only on the extracts gathered by the care of Gerhard. In order to place the shadow of Gerhard in Boyle's work, it is necessary to examine not only the places where his name is mentioned, but also those where his work is used as a source without mention. In the latter case, things are naturally more difficult. But as a first step of our investigation, we have limited ourselves to the works where Boyle explicitly refers to Gerhard, or at least to the Renaissance continental mineralogists such as Agricola, Fallopio, Cesarpino, and Maxius. And a special attention should be paid to his discussions on the generation and growth of metals and minerals. Among Boyle's early scientific writings, the text that explicitly mentions the name of Gerhard as well as those of the other continental mineralogists is his emblematic work, Skeptical Chemist, and it is more precisely in its sixth and last part entitled A Paradoxical Appendix. In denying the role of chemical principles, Carneades, who is Boyle's spokesman in the dialogue, begins by the explanation of the constitution of plants and animals. Then he turns to the mineral kingdom. Since their growth requires an enormous amount of time in the bowel of the earth, Carneades proposes to rely not on experiments, but on observations, that is to say, to study reports and narratives in the text of other writers. His objectives show that minerals were not created once for all by God at the beginning of creation of the world, but they are being formed even now. Boyle first presents the case of growth of stalactite in the French cave called Gouttière. Then he speaks of the growth of diamonds based on the memoirs of the voyage in East Indies, which were written by the Dutch traveller Jan van Linschoten and by another author, the Portuguese botanist Garcia da Oliveira. If these two testimonies are sufficient to prove the growth of minerals, Carneades argues for that of metals by quoting successively eight reports from continental writers of good note. Most of these narratives are in Latin, and this creates a singular atmosphere in this part of the Skeptical Chemist, because there is no other part in this work where such a concentration of Latin quotations is found. It is true that Carneades finds many affirmative narratives on the growth of metals in experienced chemists, but he prefers furnishing the reports of learned mineralogists who are of good credit and close to miners, rather than just repeating what credulous chemists say. He certainly believes that, to the eyes of his readers, those unsuspected writers have more authority than these chemists. The first of the continental narratives is taken from Fallopio. Boyle does not clarify to which work and to which place he is referring. What is significant is the fact that the first part of this quotation does not seem to come from Fallopio himself. Taking account of what we have seen above, we have a good reason to suspect that he is copying the quotation found in the text of Gerhard. In fact, it is the case as is shown by the comparison of the three authors, Table 7. The first part of Boyle's does not appear in Fallopio, but it does in Gerhard. Here, Boyle is faithfully following the wording of Gerhard rather than that of Fallopio. But why does Boyle fail to distinguish Fallopio's phrase? It is because the text of Gerhard contains an unusual amount of phrases in italics, and there is no break mark for these two parts in italics here. So break mark is ours. We can thus understand why Boyle could not realize that the passage in question does not come from Fallopio. Indeed, the decidedly Paracelsian idea of subterranean workers called the alchemists of fountains and minerals is not found in the Italian mineralogist. It should come from the Paracelsian treatise, the Mineralibus, or rather the pseudo-Paracelsian, the Natura Rerum. Apparently, the young Boyle, who did not show enough skepticism against his source material, could not detect this pitfall because he probably did not have the text of Fallopio at hand. Just after this, Carneades adds the reports of Pliny, Table 8. This passage is somewhat ambiguous, because Boyle does not say if he quotes the latter directly or if he continues the quotation of Fallopio, who speaks of Pliny. In reality, Fallopio does not state in his original text that he draws from Pliny the testimony of Strabo. If we turn to the text of Gerhard, we realize that it is rather through Gerhard's interpretation that Boyle is quoting these testimonies. In Gerhard, the quotation from Pliny is followed by another one from Fallopio on the island of Elba. Boyle clearly paraphrases it in English. Then he quotes Cesalpino by estimating that this man speaks better of this island for his own purpose. But we realize that this quotation is also the continuation of Gerhard's text, Table 9. We have already seen this the same passage in the Growth of Metals, and this fact led us to think that this part of the Skeptical Chemist is based on the same reading note, which he will publish with some revisions after 13 years, and that these two pieces are closely linked to the themes which attracted the young boy. He takes this testimony as the most important evidence that a certain art might be transmuted into metal in the course of time by a metallic plastic principle which resides inside art. Next, Carneades had recourse to Agricola. He states that while chemists regard this man as their adversary, he concedes the growth of metals with the case in the German town of Sagan. There, ditches from which iron was extracted regenerate again anew after 10 years, just like on the island of Elba. Boyle provides, imagine the Latin text, which is exactly the same as the one he quoted in the Growth of Metals, Table 10. Here again, the same omission of a phrase underlined. Made by Gerhard is repeated. As for the case of lead, Boyle paraphrases Galen's report about the increase in volume and weight of this metal used for the roofs of buildings or for the joints of statues. It is the same report that we have seen in the Growth of Metals. In addition to this, he gives the testimony of famous Italian writer Giovanni Boccaccio, whose words he found quoted by a diligent writer, Table 11. If it is possible to locate the quotation from Boccaccio in his geographical treatise, we can already establish that Boyle used the same extract in the Growth of Metals by giving precisely his source as Gerhard with the page number. By contrast, after the quotation from Pliny, the last sentence of Boyle does not appear in Pliny. But if we turn to Gerhard's text, we can easily understand the reason. Indeed, in this treatise, which contains an unusual quantity of phrases in italics, this passage is also put in italics, not only for the quotation from Pliny, but also for the one that explains lead mines in Germany, namely in Freifung near Amberg in Bayern. Thus, once the source identified, we can say that this part comes neither from Boccaccio nor from Pliny, but from Boyle's diligent writer, who should be our Gerhard. Then, for fear of wanting time, Carneades proposes to add only two or three more reports to this series of testimonies. The first is recorded by Gerhardus, the physic professor, who is here named explicitly, Table 12. It is the first time that Boyle mentions the name of Gerhard in this treatise, although he has been dependent on him all along. What is surprising for us is the fact that he presents Gerhard as if this man were not the same person as the one that he calls diligent writer. After these testimonies from the Latin authors of good credit, Boyle wants to add two more, both recorded only in German. The first one comes from the commentary of Johann Galch on the alchemical treatise Der kleine Bauer of Johann Grasse or Grasshoff. Grasse was a medical advisor to Ernest of Bavaria, the Prince Bishop of Cologne and Liege, as well as cousin of Emperor Rudolf II of Prague. His Der kleine Bauer itself was widely read during the 17th century. The second testimony is taken from the commentary of Johann Agricola on the treatise Chemische Medizin of the German chemist Johann Coppius. Based on all these testimonies, Kalniadis concludes that the three principles of chemists are unnecessary for the constitution of metals in mines. His discourse continues in this direction until the end of the dialogue for 20 more pages. What must be emphasized is the fact that this chain of testimonies from continental authors on the growth of metals and minerals forms the core of the last part of the skeptical chemist. By manipulating his sources, Boyle gives to his readers an impression that he knows a very wide range of authors of good credit. In reality, he is based on only one book of Gerhard for the Latin authors and does not even check whether these quotations given by Gerhard are exact or at least authentic. It is true that a more mechanical explanation will be adapted in the growth of metals of later period. However, it is now certain that this part of the skeptical chemistry is based on the same reading note. We shall now briefly analyze the work of Gerhard, 10 most known physico-chemical questions on metals, in its own light. This treatise of 130 pages in octavo is divided into 10 chapters, each of which is devoted to the one specific chemical problem, table 13, the structure of the book. The largest space is given to the first three questions. Although Boyle uses only the first chapter as far as we have seen above, we shall now examine some major points of his discussions in the present study in order to understand Gerhard's approach and the nature of his treatise. Gerhard's method is the fusion of that of Renaissance humanists who were concerned with textual problems and that of medieval alchemists who wrote doxographical works like the famous Rosarium Philosophorum. Thus, his text is full of quotations from diverse writers and each chapter compiles the ideas of the ancients, medievals, and moderns on a specific question. This makes this treatise easy to be served as a useful doxography, say, a kind of Floridorum or commonplace book on these 10 chemical problems. Like many Renaissance humanists, Gerhard is explicit as for the sources whose authority is well established, but probably he hides his direct sources, as did many of his contemporary writers. Among the numerous authorities he uses, his favorite are Aristotle, Theophrastus, Galen, and Pliny among the ancients, and Avicenna and Albertus Magnus among the medievals. As for Renaissance writers, he often quotes Agricola, Cardano, Fallopio, and Cesalpino. So far, his choice of sources is typical of Renaissance mineralogists like Cesalpino. But he frequently refers to 16th century Aristotelian philosophers like Julius Caesar Salier, Jacopo Zabarella, and Jacob Scheck of Tübingen. This aspect adds a strong academic flavor to his work. However, what is most remarkable in him and what distinguishes him from the other Renaissance mineralogists is his abundant use of medieval alchemists like Petrus Bonus, Arnold of Villanova, and namely Pseudo-Geber. To this list, we should add a series of Renaissance alchemical treatises ascribed to Marsilio Ficino, Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, Bernardus Trevisanus, Denis Zecker, Basil Valentine, and Jean d'Espagne. Gerhard also uses Paracelsian treatises, which include not only authentic ones, but also those whose authenticity is doubted by historians, such as the Natura Rerum and the Philosophy of Athenians. It has been noted that these two works, in particular, have a strong affinity to medieval alchemy among the treatises attributed to him. What Gerhard wants to establish through a dense texture of multiple quotations from these authors is the defense of transmutatory art against anti-chemists and harmonization of diverse opinions not only among the chemists themselves, but also between these chemists and Renaissance mineralogists. As I have shown in my book, The fusion of Renaissance mineralogy stemming from Agricola with Paracelsian chemistry took place in the beginning of the 17th century by the work entitled Gemmellum et Lapidum Historia, published in Hanau in 1609. This treaty is considered as the most important mineralogical work of that century. Its author is Anselmus Boethius de Bode, a mineralogist of the Emperor Rudolf II. What is significant in his work is the fact that, while providing natural explanation for occult powers traditionally ascribed to precious stones, they both advanced the theories of architectonic spirit and its seminal power for mineral formation under the clear influence of Paracelsians such as Petrus Severinus and Joseph Kersetanus. Several writers, among others, Daniel Sennert, followed his path. We can place the work of Gerhard in the historical context of this tradition. But what is characteristic of his work is the fact that he pushes this fusion towards its extremity, by searching the harmony of the ideas of Paracelsus himself with the dominant current of the medieval alchemy of Pseudo-Geber. The work of Gerhard is very rare, and there is very little information about his life and his work's influence. How could Boyle know of this treatise and obtain it? According to our research on his correspondence, his work diary, and his manuscripts in the Boyle papers, there is no trace of Gerhard. The correspondence of Henry Oldenburg does not help us either. In my study on certain physiological essays, where Boyle discusses the regeneration of minerals, I have examined some major mineralogical themes which attracted the mind of the young Boyle. Among these themes, there is a notion of special mineralizing juice called Gur, G-U-R. He notes that this notion is only recorded in one or two German treatises, one of which is the Zalepta of Matthias. But he could not directly read this treatise because it is written in German. However, he quotes once Matthias through the work of Gerhard. So I suppose that his source might be Gerhard and went through his entire treatise in vain. So it develops discussions neither on Guru nor on lapidifying juice, a closer idea advanced by Agricola. However, my colleague discovered a clue which led us to Boyle's source first in Metallography by John Webster and then in Philosophical Essay by Thomas Shirley. These two close followers of Boyle's mineralogy explain the way in which the idea of Guru was transmitted to him. According to them, this notion is recorded in a Latin treatise entitled Arca Arcani Artificiosissimi, included in the sixth and last volume of the Theatrum Chemicum of the Detzner Press. But this work is in fact a translation of Der große Bauer and Der kleine Bauer by Johann Grasse. Boyle himself must have heard of the reputation of Grasse's work at latest in 1659, because Samuel Hartlieb explained him in two letters that a young Claudius was translating the German treatise called Bauer for Boyle in his house. Thus, Hartlieb's circle seems to have played an important role in the transmission of the idea of Guru. But can the same thing be said about Gerhard's work? Unfortunately, our research of the Hartlieb's paper has not yielded conclusive evidence on the issue so far. Facing this situation, we took notice of another fact. So, in the fourth essay, which is an addition dated around 1660 to the usefulness of natural philosophy, composed very early around 1649, Boyle speaks of a certain doctor, Jo Conradus Gerhardus. According to Boyle, this man wrote a small treatise called Physico-Chemicarium Questions, which contains testimonies about the continuous growth of metals. In table 14, I put a quotation. Ça va?
7 minutes.
Ok. Donc, vous pouvez lire la station, je passe la station. Je vais expliquer quand même. Hein. This Konrad Gerhard should be Johann Konrad Gerhard, the father of our Gerhard. He was a chemist and physician of the German prince Wolfgang II of Hohenlohe and the author of a treatise Extractum Chemicalium Quaestionum of Lapide Philosophium, published in Strasbourg, 1616, but not the author of the Decus Quaestionum Physico Chemicalium. At this point, Boyle probably confused the father and the son, just as Pierre Boyle had made the same error in the famous inventory for chemical treatise, Bibliotheca Chemica. But that is not all. For Boyle clearly states that the testimony of Konrad Gerhard was quoted again by Senard. After this passage, he adds the observation of Linz Forsten and Garcia de Orta on the growth of diamonds, which we have already seen in the skeptical chemistry. Given Boyle's habit in quotation, we can think that he is here reading only the text of Senard and probably not that of Konrad Gerhard. Let us now turn to Senard himself. Boyle does not provide any more information to identify the passage in question. However, since the editors of the new edition of his work suggested the treatise De Chemicorum cum Aristotelicis et Galenicis consensu et dissensu as his source, we have been able to find it. It is in the chapter 9 where Senard interprets the concept of seeds set by the Danish Paracelsian Petrus Severinus. Having explained all the main theories on the origin of forms which have been advanced by philosophers and chemists, Senard takes up the formation of metals. His discussion is followed by a series of reports on the regeneration of metals, which he draws from Joe Conradus Gerhardus. Here, one reads the testimonies of the continental authors we have seen, such as Pliny, Boccaccio, Falloppio, Cesalpino, and Garcia de Orta. Most of the elements of this passage will be found, are also found in the text of Gerhard the Son in a revised way in italics. After this passage from Gerhard the Father, Senard himself continues his discussions on the devoted theory of the architectonic spirit and its seminal power for mineral formation. Evidently, he accepts these theories and ends the chapter. This last finding led us to consider that the young Boyle first came to notice the name of Johann Conradus Gerhardus and his treatise through his reading of Senard. As he was greatly interested in testimonies on the growth of metals, he wanted to obtain this treatise. Boyle did obtain the work of Gerhard the son, and not the Gerhard the father. Although the title of the name and its author were slightly different, since he found in it what he had been looking for, he was very happy to use it for his own work. Two questions still remain: whether Boyle also obtained the treatise of Gerhard the father, and or whether he realized this confusion of the father and son and their two books. Je vais aller à la conclusion. In the present study, we have examined in detail some key testimonies on the growth of metals which the young Boyle quotes from continental writers. Through this surgical analysis, we have identified the main source of a series of his quotations and have clarified the way in which he used this source material to increase the credibility of his discourse. Despite numerous quotations which impress his readers, the young Boyle probably did not read these works he was quoting at first hand. It is particularly true concerning those written in Latin and German. In reality, he was largely dependent on a single small but very useful compendium of doxographical nature. This discovery would make one suspect that Boyle used the same kind of tools in other fields such as pharmacology, natural history, chemistry, and even philosophy. We have also noted that the young boy was interested in the Zarepta of Baptist and the commentary of Johann Wolff on the work called Der kleine Bauer. Our research has also led us to the issue of the resemblance of contents between the works of Gerhard the Father and that of Gerhard the Son. We have been unable to deal with all these issues in the present study. They are, of course, our next target. As a final remark, we would like to emphasize once again the role played by Senard. Not only he provides a crucial link between Gerhard and Boyle, but also his discussions on the concept of seed touched upon issues such as spontaneous generation, mineral formation, and the Bothe's ideas of the architectonic spirit and its seminal power. All these topics fascinated the mind of the young boy. Thank you for your attention.
Bien, vous avez fait là, je me semble.